Genesis 26, the 27th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 6, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 26. Last week, just in passing, I mentioned that I was going to postpone until this week talking about why it is that Isaac rates so small amount of space in Genesis. Well, the reason that I was postponing until this week is so that I would have another week to figure that out. And I would like to postpone it for another week, but that's awkward. So we're just going to go on marching through. We're going to do Genesis 26. But it raises a lot of difficult questions that I'm not confident that I have found the answers to. So I've decided to make this a group project. We'll go through this, and I encourage you to be thinking along with me to try to figure out the answers to some of these puzzles. The first one is, why is there so little about Isaac? Well, there's so much build-up to Isaac, and then he's one chapter. He's essentially one chapter out of 50. So why is there so little about Isaac? The second is, in this chapter, there are three events, kind of, and they are all close parallels to things that happened in the life of Abraham. Why is it that the only three incidents that we have with Isaac are all paralleled with Abraham? And the next is, the author of Genesis seems to be departing from chronological order. So the tricky issue is, why has he put things in the order that he's put them? There must be some reason. And hopefully you'll be able to tell me. Okay, let's look at this. Genesis chapter 26, 1 through 11. The first part. Now there was a famine in the land, besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands. And I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he was afraid to say, "my wife," thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. And it came about, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say, 'She is my sister'?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I said, 'Lest I die on account of her.'" And Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Okay, so there's another famine in this land. They're at in the Negev, the southern part of Israel, where it's virtually desert. There's a little bit of rainfall, but it's very dry. And there's another famine, probably a lack of water. That's what I would assume, but it doesn't say for sure. This is a different famine from the one that caused Abraham to go down to Egypt. Interestingly, this is some promised land. God takes Abraham to this land that he says that I will show you. They go to this land, and it's desolate, and it's prone to famine. It's hardly the ideal place to be going, which is, I think, interesting, especially in light of some of the comments that were made in the announcements. God, when he makes provision for his people, oftentimes it is not abundant provision, it's just enough. Life is hard. And it's always been striking to me that when he led the people out of Egypt, where do they go? They go in the desert. And there's no food. So he provides for them. But how does he provide for them? It's just enough for the day. And it's not gourmet meals. It's just what they need. No more, no less. And God seems to be attracted to this just in time, just enough kind of perspective. It's just what we need to get through life, nothing more, nothing less. And that seems to be what life is about. There's a famine. He goes, he heads out. Where is he going to go? Well, the pattern in the Old Testament is if there's famine in Israel, where you go is Egypt. That makes sense. The famine is probably drought caused. The peculiar thing about Egypt is, well, the thing that's not peculiar, it's probably in the same weather patterns. I don't know that for sure, but similar weather patterns. But the peculiar thing about Egypt is the crops there are not dependent on the rain. The crops in Egypt are dependent on the Nile. And so they oftentimes would have crops when in Palestine there is not enough rain to grow crops. So it's the logical place to go. That's where Isaac heads for, and Gerar is on the way to Egypt. So he's taking off. He's probably headed towards Egypt. And Gerar is a Philistine city, and there's evidence that there were storage bins that had been built in Gerar, so it was probably a place where he could get food on his way further south to Egypt. Now it says that he goes to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. If you remember back to Abraham goes to Gerar and Abimelech is there. But if you work out the chronology, that had to have been about 70 years earlier. So either this is the same Abimelech, but a lot older, or it's a different Abimelech. And there seems to be evidence that makes it probable that Abimelech is a title rather than a name. Much like Pharaoh is the title of the ruler of Egypt, Abimelech seems to have either been the name of the ruler of the Philistines in Gerar, or it's a frequent throne name, the name that someone takes on as soon as they ascend to the position. In the story of David, there's a time when David feigns madness to get away from a Philistine king. And that's recorded in 1 Samuel. Let's see, where is that? In In 1 Samuel 21:10 through 15, it talks about that event. Then in Psalms 34, David writes a psalm about that event. And the title to that psalm is Psalm of David When He Feigned Madness Before Abimelech. Well, in 1 Samuel, we have the name of the king of Gerar, and it's a different name than Abimelech. So apparently it's a title or a throne name that the king of Gerar takes on. Okay, so either it's the same Abimelech, a lot older, or we're talking about a different Abimelech. God appears to him. So just as we had in the case of Abraham, where on several occasions God appears to Abraham and proclaims a blessing on him, here God appears to Isaac and proclaims a blessing. And it is very similar. The content of the blessing is very similar, and the structure of the blessing is very similar. Notice that this blessing begins with do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land in which I shall tell you. If you'll recall back in Genesis 12, when God spoke to Abraham, he said, go to the land which I will show you. Here it's stay in the land which I will tell you. Even the structure of the sentence is very similar. There it was an appeal to Abraham to go into the unknown, so to take a risk, and therefore it required faith. Here, what God is doing is saying, stay in the land that I will tell you, and here there's risk, because it's famine. So once again, it's requiring faith on the part of Isaac. Then the blessing that is made is very similar to blessings that were made to Abraham. It's kind of a composite. The things that are repeated, which are directly from blessings that were made to Abraham. He says, I will bless you. That was direct repetition of what God had said to Abraham. He says, to you and your descendants, I will give this land. He says, I will establish an oath with your father. He says, I will establish oath with your father. I must have misquoted that. The oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. There he's just repeating, he's just affirming the oath that he had given to Abraham. He says his descendants will be like stars. He says he will give the descendants the land. And he says, all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. So these are repetitions of blessings that were made to Abraham. There's nothing really new here. So Isaac is the inheritor of the blessings that God had made to Abraham. On what basis? On the basis of Abraham's obedience to God. It's not on the basis of anything Isaac has done. It's on the basis of Abraham's obedience. Okay, so God has announced blessings, much like he did to Abraham, is calling on Isaac to be faithful and to do something that's risky, just like he had done with Abraham. Okay. Now, this little incident that occurs in Gerar is very interesting, I think. It's very similar to the incident which Abraham had. Isaac tells the men of Gerar that Rebekah is his sister. If you will recall, that's the same strategy that Abraham had used on two different occasions. Abraham had come into this wild area where there is no law, and Abraham apparently had the practice of whenever he went to a new city, he would say, Sarah, she's my sister. Why? Because apparently it was common practice in that area that if someone liked a woman, was attracted to a woman who was married, they would knock off the husband so that they could have the wife. So that was his strategy to protect his own life. Well, this is like father, like son. Isaac is adopting the same strategy. Now, I don't know how much to make of this, but I have been struck of recently the extent to which I have noticed in my own children that in interpersonal relations, they have some of the same patterns that I have. I mean, for better or for worse, they have some of the same patterns that I have. And I don't think that's just genes. I think part of that, at least, is stuff that they've picked up. That for better or for worse, our children are students of their parents. And they learn a lot from their parents, and they end up repeating those patterns that they've learned. In any case, Isaac is repeating this particular strategy. He's adopted it as his own. But what's interesting here is nothing happens. No one tries to take Rebekah. Both times when Abraham had done this, in fact, the ruler of the area had taken Sarah, both in Egypt and in Gerar. But here, nothing happens. And it says, this is an interesting and I think very significant verse, verse 8, and it came about when he had been there a long time. So it is a long time that no one has done anything bad to Rebekah. So I think that the author is stressing the fact that Isaac had exaggerated the danger. The danger that was really there in Abraham's time is not really there in Isaac's time, and yet he's employing the same strategy that Abraham had. Abraham's was a desperate strategy in a desperate situation. Isaac's is a desperate strategy, but it's not a desperate situation. And furthermore, it's interesting that when Abraham said Sarah was his sister, that was a half-truth. Sarah was his half-sister. In this case, it's further from the truth. He's stretching it even further. And in the other two instances with Abraham, where he employed the strategy, in both times, God came through to save him from the situation and allow Abraham to live with Sarah as his wife freely and openly. In this case, there's no divine intervention because there isn't the desperate kind of situation. The way that this is made apparent and public is the king happens to see Isaac relating to Rebekah like one would relate to a wife rather than one would relate to a sister. And I assume it's just he happens to see in a window, see Isaac touching Rebekah in a way that would only be appropriate in a marriage. And therefore, he concludes, that's not his sister, that's his wife. So it's an accident that makes this known. Abimelech talks to Isaac and he says, what have you done? I mean, this could have been disastrous. Someone could have lain with Rebekah and brought guilt on our whole community. And that would have been horrible. So he's accusatory of Isaac for what he has done, just as Abimelech had been with respect to Abraham earlier. And Abimelech says to his people, to the people of Gerar, don't touch either Isaac or Rebekah. They need to be kept safe. Now, presumably, this is in keeping with the covenant that had been made with Abraham earlier. Abraham had made a covenant with Abimelech that they would not deal falsely with one another and that they would not do harm to one another and to their descendants, that those were to be extended on. And so Abimelech is saying, hands off these two. What's interesting about the comparison of what Isaac does and what Abraham does is what Abraham did was, I think, ultimately wrong, but it was understandable. Here Isaac is repeating the same pattern, but it's not understandable. He's exaggerated the dangers of the situation, and yet he's still employing the strategy. There's a sense in which it is a graver wrong, I think, and that we are intended to see it that way. And I suspect that part of what's going on here is the author is highlighting a situation in which deception has been employed by Isaac. There was deception employed by Abraham, understandably. There's deception being employed by Isaac here, less understandably. And then we're going to see Jacob, his son, employing deception to an even greater degree. So from one generation to another, a trait is being developed and taken to a further extreme. Now, the chronology here is a little bit tricky to sort out. I think it makes the most sense that Isaac and Rebekah must not have their children at the time they go to Gerar. If they have their children in tow when they go to Gerar, he's got more to explain. He's got to explain where they came from. So if they have not been born yet, then the first part of the chapter precedes the events of the previous chapter, probably two chapters. And that would mean that, let's see, the twins were born when Abraham was 160 years old. So Isaac at this time, if it's before the twins are born, Isaac is older than 40 and younger than 60 at the time of this event at the beginning of the chapter. And that would mean that the first part of this chapter is happening before Abraham is 160 years old. But as we move on in the chapter, it refers to the death of Abraham in verse 18. So that part of the chapter would have to come much, much later, after the death of Abraham, indicating that Isaac had to have been in Gerar for over 15 years. If you follow the logic and you put it all together. So the chronology here appears to be, things are not in chronological order. The author has moved things around for a different purpose. And he appears to have put all of these events in the life of Isaac, where the only events where Isaac is the main character have all been packed into chapter 26 and chapter 26 alone. Okay. Okay, now I got my pages out of order. Okay. Let's read the next section, verses 12 through 17. Now Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold. And the Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with earth. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are too powerful for us." And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. So following this instance where Isaac has been faithless and deceitful, I would say. I mean, there's faithlessness involved because God has promised to look after him. And yet Isaac employs this desperate strategy to take care of himself. Nevertheless, the next passage is talking about God blessing Isaac despite his faithlessness. And he blesses him greatly. Isaac plants, he sows the fields with seed, which is interesting because Abraham, as far as we know, was not a farmer. So Isaac is doing something a little different here. He's farming. And he sows and he reaps a hundredfold in the same year. So for every seed planted, he gets 100 seeds back. Now, I was going to look this up. I have run across figures as to what kind of return you could expect from your planting. And I couldn't find it readily, but my recollection is that a very good year would still be in the single digits of return. It's ninefold or less. I can't remember exactly what it is. 100-fold is incredible. In those times, 100-fold return is absolutely incredible. Well, with 100-fold return on your grain, you're going to have much more grain than your neighbors. So here we, and it's not clear when this starts. I don't know whether famine is still going on when he's getting a hundredfold return on his planting or not. Either way, though, this is marginal land for farming. And with a hundredfold, he's going to be way out producing everybody else in the area. As a result, he's going to be selling to people who are having trouble just making enough, probably. And he's selling out of his abundance. Well, you can imagine that situation, especially if it's still in the time of famine, that people are going to be envious of that, of his situation. And you can see how envy would develop. Envy wouldn't have to develop. They could just rejoice that grain is being produced in abundance and it's available for them to buy. But that's not the perspective they're taking. They're just seeing it as, here's someone who is doing very well while we're suffering. He should be out of here. So they drive him out. Now, it's not clear whether these wells were filled earlier or whether they're filled now for the very purpose of driving him out. My suspicion is it's the latter, that they're filling the wells to encourage him to move on, to move further. In any case, we know that there is animosity towards Isaac and Abimelech becomes concerned. And my guess is that Abimelech is concerned because he has made an oath, or his predecessor has made an oath with Abraham, that this kind of mutual respect, the people of Gerar for the descendants of Abraham and vice versa. And he's concerned that the people of Gerar are so envious of Isaac's situation that they might act out violently. And so Abimelech steps in and says, you've got to move on. You are too great for us. So what's interesting here is the blessing has become, in a sense, a curse. The blessing has set Isaac apart from the rest of the people. And people don't like those who are set apart from them. It creates envy and friction. Okay. Okay, the next section, 18 through 25. Then Isaac dug again the wells of water, which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the same names which his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, the water is ours. So he named the well Essek, because they contended with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too. So he named it Sitna. And he moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he named it Rehoboth, for he said, at last the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. Then he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants, and for the sake of my servant Abraham. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. This is very interesting. There's a lot of envy in Gerar towards Isaac. And as a result, he's being forced to move away from Gerar. And he moves away gradually. He moves a little bit further. He digs a well. He finds water. And what happens? The people of Gerar says, that's our water. What is Isaac's response? He says, okay, I'll move on. Rather than standing for his rights, it should be his water. He says, I'll move on. And the next well, the same thing happens. And what's Isaac's response? Again, I'll move on. It's reminiscent of Abraham's response to the problem of in which he and Lot had too many possessions. And what was Abraham's solution to the problem? He says, we've got to divide. We've got to go our separate ways because the land will not support all of our livestock, both of our flocks. And he says, you pick first. Abraham was willing to give up. He should have had the right to pick first. He's the older. He's the one in charge of the whole operation. He should have been able to pick land first. But in order to keep the peace, he says, no, Lot, you pick first. Isaac is doing a similar thing here. He's saying, he had every right to the well that he dug. But it's a source of conflict, and he says, I'm not going to fight for that right. I'm moving on. And it happens again, the same thing. I'm not going to fight for my right. I'm moving on. And in the end, he moves to a place called where he digs a well, and now there's no contention. He says, at last the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. God has provided. He moves again, and still he finds water and is able to stay there. Then, right after that, we have he goes to Beersheba, which is his home base. That's the place where Abraham had actually made an oath with Abimelech earlier. That's where they had made their agreement. And God appears to him again and blesses him again. So after this display of generosity and wanting to avoid a needless conflict, his self-sacrifice, God blesses him again. He comes to him and says, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. So again, a repetition of the blessing that he has made and the reassurance that I'm with you. I'll take care of you. You've done what I've wanted you to do. And Isaac's response, he builds an altar and he gives thanks to God for God's provision and his care for him. And interestingly, again, his servants strike water. So he's been able to strike water consistently in an area where water is very hard to come by. God has truly blessed him, both in abundant crops and with water. But God hasn't made things perfectly smooth. There's been difficulties along the way as well. Okay, then the last section, he makes a covenant with Abimelech, verse 26 through 33. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzath and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? And they said, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will not do us harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord. Then he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. And in the morning they arose early and exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Now it came about in the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, we have found water. So he called it Sheba. There it is. He called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. Okay, so again, just as in the life of Abraham, Isaac ends up making a covenant with Abimelech. But this time, it appears as though Abimelech is at the disadvantage. Abimelech, in the earlier one, if you will recall, Abimelech came to him and wanted to make a covenant. It was kind of a mutual defense treaty. And at the end of it, Abraham was extremely glad. It was a significant event that was giving Abraham some security. We don't have the same kind of response here from Isaac. This doesn't seem to be a situation in which Isaac benefits much from this agreement. Abimelech seems to be the one who's benefiting from this agreement. In any case, Abimelech has come to him, wants to have assurance that they will be in peace. And Isaac apparently has grown to have quite a household. It had said earlier that he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household. Presumably that means lots of servants. So Isaac has apparently become a significant force. And Abimelech makes an agreement much like the one that had been made between Abimelech and Abraham. They have a feast to seal the deal. They don't go through all of the traditional oath-making ceremonies that occurred in the time of Abraham. And then Abimelech goes home. And immediately afterwards, once again, his servants strike water. This well, he calls Sheba, which means seven. Now, if you'll recall earlier, Abraham, when he dug a well there, he called it Beersheba, Sheba meaning oath, because he had just concluded an oath with Abimelech. So it was the well of the oath. But Sheba, that means well, is almost identical to the word Sheba that means seven. And here he digs a well and he calls it seven, presumably because it's the seventh well that they have found. We don't have a listing of all seven here. I think if you add them up, I think it's five or six. But presumably it's the seventh well. So this is some kind of play on words. But seven and oath are apparently related terms. When an oath was made, usually seven animals were part of the ceremony. Okay. So again, God is providing for him much in the way that God had provided for Abraham. Now, last verse, just quickly, so this switches to Esau, verses 34 and 35. And when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basmath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Esau should have known that his family did not care for Canaanite women. If you will recall, Abraham and Sarah decided that they did not want Isaac to marry a woman from among the Canaanites, a local woman. So they had a servant go back to Mesopotamia, back to Haran, to find a wife for Isaac. Esau doesn't seem to take that into account, and he marries a Canaanite woman. Not only does he marry one Canaanite woman, but he marries a second Canaanite woman. So apparently in disregard of the values of his family, which is interesting because earlier in the chapter before, he had sold his birthright, indicating that he didn't value the things that his family had valued. So Esau has set out on a different path. He has a different set of things that he values, and we get a hint of that here. And not unexpectedly, it says it brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Just as Sarah was disturbed about the selection of wives locally, Rebekah and Isaac are grieved by that as well. Okay, so that's the chapter in which Isaac shows up as the main character. Now, what do we make of this? And this is the part that I'm not sure what... I'll give it my best stab, but I'm not entirely satisfied with this. I think that we are truly to see Isaac as being a significant person. He is too important in the build-up up to this time for us to not see him as a significant person. The promise that God had made to Abraham that he would have a son who would inherit the promises that were made to him, that looms very large in the whole story of Abraham. And his birth is a big deal. Isaac's birth is a very big deal. I find it hard to believe then that Isaac is not a significant person in the scheme of things. However, he doesn't rate much space. And why doesn't he rate much space? I think that the answer is because the author of Genesis is not just giving us the lives of the patriarchs, but rather he's tracing God's activity in their lives and his interaction with them in such a way that he takes them and builds faith into their lives. He takes them as they are, and over a period of time, he makes them faithful, obedient servants of Yahweh. And in order to make that story, he's decided that Isaac, all that he needs to say about Isaac is, first of all, that Isaac is much like his father. My guess is that that's why we have parallel incidents from the life of Abraham and the life of Isaac, and that's all we have is parallel incidents. He blesses him much like he did, like he blessed Abraham. He asks him to be faithful much like he had asked Abraham to be faithful. In the incident with Isaac, and the way he, the strategy that he employs to deal with being in Gerar and the possibility of being killed because of Rebekah. God treats him there much like he did Abraham. The oath is, that he makes with Abimelech, that's very similar to what Abraham did. I think what we are to understand is Isaac is much like his father. And God goes on with, in the rest of his life, to deal with Isaac much like he did with Abraham. The difference, there is, I suspect that we are supposed to see that Isaac is like his father, but he is a little more deceptive. There's something, he's taken a fault of Abraham's and has expanded on that fault. And from then on, the author of Genesis is basically going to skip over Isaac and of faithfulness. So I think that's what's going on here. The other thing that I think is interesting here is I think that this chapter helps us to understand why anti-Semitism is so prevalent in the world. It's interesting to see here that Isaac has been blessed, and the result of that blessing is that it causes envy. The blessing singles him out and makes him different. And by making him different, it brings on the envy of the surrounding people. And instead of looking at the blessing that's been bestowed on Isaac as something that they can benefit from as well, I mean, Isaac is producing more food in the area. And in those times, you couldn't export food. It was too expensive to transport food to make it economically make any sense to export food. So the food's going to stay there. He can only eat so much. So the blessing on Isaac is truly a blessing on everyone if they would choose to see it that way. But they look at it and they say, no, it's an uneven kind of thing. And therefore, he's got to go. He's a problem, not a blessing to us. I may have talked about this in here before. If I have, I'm sorry. But I've been reading a book by Solzhenitsyn called 200 Years Together. Solzhenitsyn is a novelist, but he's an unusual novelist. And he's been writing a novel on the Russian Revolution, and it has taken him years to do it. And I think he's still working on it. He's come out with actually several novels based on the Russian Revolution, but he's still continuing with this project. But in the course of writing these novels, he keeps running into situations in which there are Jews involved in the revolutionary movement. And he's been intrigued by the interaction between the Jews and the Russians in this story of the Russian Revolution. So he took 2 years out of his project writing on these novels about the Russian Revolution to write a 1,000-page piece on the history of the relations between Jews and Russians. You gotta love it. He's a weird fellow. But I've got volume one of that, and I've started reading through it, and it is, I think, fascinating. As he tells the story, this is my simplified version of his story, and I've only read the first part of it, so this is just the early stages, but I can already see the pattern, and the pattern is fascinating. The Jews spread out from Israel, even before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, they began to spread out. But certainly after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, they're going in all directions. One of the directions that was quite common for Jews to go was up to the shores of the Black Sea, all around the Black Sea. They settled in those areas, and that's where they first came into contact with any Russians. And what happens is, it has been ingrained in them since the exile that God demands that they obey the laws that God had given to them through Moses. And in particular, they are very insistent on being separate and distinct, having a separate and distinct culture. They insist on eating kosher. They insist on the long sideburns, the corner, not cutting the corners of their beards, et cetera, all those trappings of being Jewish that had been developed. So they insist on being culturally separate when they go to the shores of the Black Sea. As a result, they are not embraced and incorporated into the culture. They're always on the outskirts of the culture. And by tradition, they were farmers, but they go to the shores of the Black Sea, and they have trouble getting rights to own land. So farming becomes a difficult thing for them to do. Even if they get land, they don't have a recognized title to it. So they don't have any security in it. So what happens is they change occupations. And what occupations do they change to? Well, they change to occupations that are mobile. Generally speaking, they like mobile occupations. And the two that they gravitate towards are becoming merchants and becoming bankers. And they learned banking from tribes in a particular tribe in Central Asia. They developed those skills, that body of knowledge, and they developed it and carried it into Europe. As merchants, the product that they gravitated towards was selling wine, because it was very lucrative, and they had contacts where they could get wines from various areas and sell them to a very eager market among the Russians. The Russians like alcohol. What's interesting then is, because they are merchants of wine, they sell the wine to the Russians. The Russian men in particular would get drunk and would get nasty and wouldn't do their work, and it had all kinds of bad consequences. And the people would hold the Jews to blame. They're the ones who wrecked our society. They're the ones that wrecked our families. They're the ones who wrecked our economy. The same thing happens with banking. People are very willing to borrow money, but it's always aggravating when you have to pay it back. And they create a great deal of animosity there as well. So the two occupations that they gravitate towards are very conducive to creating enemies. And so the pattern that we see is Jews will move into an area. Initially, they are greeted with open arms. They'll begin doing their business. They will be very successful in their business, on the one hand. But on the other hand, they create a great deal of animosity. The people become so enraged that it will erupt in a violent mob action of destroying Jews' houses and kicking them out of the town. The Jews will pick up and they'll go elsewhere, and the pattern starts all over again. in Paul Johnson's The History of the Jews, you can he traces the history of the Jews from Abraham all the way to the present. And particularly in modern times, one of the patterns that you see is the same one. That is, Jews will go somewhere, and initially they stay culturally separate, but they will do well. That creates animosity, and they get driven away. So in more modern times, the Jews just adapted another strategy, and that is, well, we'll assimilate in. And particularly in Europe, they assimilated in. And they thought, if we will just assimilate, then there won't be hatred towards us, because we'll be like everybody else. But the problem is, they tended to be very talented. So they would assimilate in, and then in various aspects of European culture, they would excel. And as soon as they excelled, everybody would say, well, remember, they're Jews. And it created a great deal of envy and animosity towards Jews. And that was the situation that had developed at the time of World War II. So I think that what we see here in chapter 26 is just foreshadowing of the problem that is constantly going to haunt the Jews wherever they go. And that is, the blessing of God is going to be received by the surrounding peoples, not as a blessing, but they're going to see it as, it's going to turn out to be a curse, in that instead of enjoying the fact that they have blessed people among them and benefiting from that gift, they see it as a problem and want to get rid of them. Okay, I have already run over time, so I guess I better save your questions for next time, and we'll deal with them then. Thanks.